part of being a part of a faith tradition is you're told the way things are supposed to be, but you're always in tension between the way they say things are supposed to be versus the way things really are. And it's an exhausting position to be in, and you're always trying to reconcile them, and it never reconciles. Now that I'm a humanist, I would say that I'm finding that the world makes more sense to me. You know, I don't come with expectations that are unrealistic or that don't fit the way the world is.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this week's episode, Godless in Dixie, the net gains of losing religion, and God makes you fat and ruins your sex life. All coming up on this episode. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm your host for this week's episode, along with Kim Ellington. And the both of us had the pleasure of speaking with another very interesting humanist. And he has a lot of wonderful things to say. So instead of telling you about it, we're going to get right into it and play the interview with Neil Carter.
Today, we welcome Neil Carter, a father, a teacher, and Godless in Dixie. Neil, welcome to our show.
Welcome, Neil.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
All right. So, folks, Neil, if you don't know too much about him, which I doubt because he's made quite a name for himself recently, on Pathos with his blog Godless in Dixie. So this is something for a Southerner like myself. I think most of our listeners know now that although I was raised in New Hampshire, I've lived in North Carolina now for 25 years. So for those of us who live completely surrounded by religion on an almost constant basis, Neil's blog has been a lifesaver for many, I think, and absolutely fascinating to me to see kind of inside a fundamentalist viewpoint, but from the outside, which is pretty cool. Good job, Neil.
Thank you. That's a pretty good description, too.
So tell us a little bit about your blog. For anybody out there who has not been introduced to it yet, what would you tell them about it?
Well, my blog is mainly about my own struggles with trying to work my way out of thinking like a religious person, because I grew up as a Southern Baptist in the heart of Mississippi, which is the buckle of the Bible Belt, although that's what everybody says about where they grew up. But
everybody claims the buckle.
They do. They really do. But
I think North Carolina is like the little pokey thing that goes through the holes in the belt, actually.
Yeah, or at least one of the little studs on the end. Well, in Mississippi, you know, we score consistently as the number one most religious state in the country every year. And on multiple factors, we're neck and neck with Utah and Oklahoma most of the time. But growing up as a Southern Baptist in Mississippi, I really was in the thick of evangelical culture. And I was in it for all of my life up until my mid-30s. But really, those last 20 years leading up to my mid-30s were very intense for me. I was very involved, and I fell into some leadership roles in different settings and went to seminary and eventually came to the point where I decided I didn't believe any of it anymore. In fact, I had just finished writing a book by the time I was about 35. And almost immediately after writing the book, I thought, you know what? I don't think I believe any of this stuff. So the next 3 or 4 years of unpacking my own deconversion was a really all-consuming kind of experience. And so it's going to take a while to finish unpacking it. And what I found is it helps me to write about it as I do it. And the more I write about it, the more I realize there's a lot of other people out there that have had the exact same experience. They've had to work their way out of their religious background. And it's a lot to work through because there's a lot of social pressure to stay inside the group. And once you're outside of that group and outside that culture, there can be a lot of condemnation and a lot of disappointment. So working through all of those things is what I write about. And the people that read my stuff read it for that reason, because they really identify with that. That's what the blog's about.
Neil, would you say that the majority of your readers are already committed atheists, or are they kind of on the fence, or are they Christians? Where do you think they sit?
It's pretty much the whole gamut. What I've found is, and I'm surprised, when I first started writing, I thought that the only people who would really like what I was writing about were Southerners. You know, that was the first thing, was I thought, you know, Godless in Dixie was a catchy name, and I thought people from the South would get where I was coming from. But outside the South, I didn't think anybody would. But I've come to see that there's people all over the country that identify with this, because evangelicalism is something that spreads all over. It's not just where I live. And what I found is that because I identify so easily with a wide range of ideologies, because I grew up Christian and now I'm not, when I write about those things, I'm pretty respectful of all the phases in between, because I feel like I've passed through those myself. And because I'm respectful of all those phases, and because I know how to talk about both the people who are inside and the people who are out in ways that they identify with, I've gotten a lot of readers that are still Christians that like the way I write about my own questions. They find it interesting, even if they disagree with me. Mm-hmm. They tend to be very complimentary about the fact that I don't bash them and what they believe, which is less of a problem for me. I don't do that because it was very recently that I was a Christian myself. So I'm not going to come out and talk about feeling like they're stupid, because I was one of those just recently. And I still remember the thought processes I had and how I reasoned through things while I was still a Christian. So I'm less inclined to be disrespectful. And that gives me a lot of Christian readers. And then there's a lot of people who, like you said, are on the fence. They're trying to work through their questions, and they need to be able to read somebody who can think out loud about those things without jumping all the way to one side or the other. And that's real hard to avoid doing sometimes. Mm. And I've been out of the faith world enough years now to where I do have to still work sometimes to get back into it and to remember how I thought back when I used to think that way. So really, it's the whole gamut.
I would imagine that you would be seen as a threat to many Christians. Do you find that's a problem? And have you ever been threatened directly?
Yes. Well, I had someone very close to me when they first found out that I was an atheist. I knew him for a couple of years before he found out. I'm not sure how it was he didn't find out. I think he just wasn't connected to social media. Hmm. But he found out one day, and the next time I saw him, he said, "You know, you're a dangerous person." And I was kind of shocked when he said that, because he knew me well enough to know that I'm about one of the safest people you'll ever meet. But what he meant was, I know the Christian faith inside and out.
Yeah.
And when I talk about it, I talk as one who has a lot of inside knowledge about it. So now that I'm outside, that makes me like a spy, you know? I'm the defector that your government's worried about selling your secrets. So I get that feel from people. And I also think that it feels threatening to people who used to know me in my former life. I think they're afraid that if they talk to me too much, they might be enticed to the dark side. And so they kind of steer clear of me. And so while I've made lots of new friends, the old friends don't come around much. And I think it's because I scare them.
Yeah. Well, you know how they say that there are both out-groups and in-groups, but you're like an in-group guy with an out-group idea, and that is dangerous.
Yeah, it is. Well, I tend to think of myself like a, you know how an ambassador represents one country but lives in another?
Uh-huh.
And because of that, he sort of has a dual citizenship, and he has to learn how to think like both countries. Mm. And his job is to facilitate communication between the two. That's kind of like what I am. At this point, I am an expatriate from evangelicalism, but I live in the capital city. And my job, in a way, is to represent humanists and non-believers to evangelical Christians, and sometimes vice versa, because I get a lot of contact from atheists who live outside, especially outside the United States, that they write me and they say, "I don't understand what you're even talking about. Who even thinks this way? You know, why do they think this way? Why do they say this?" And I have to stop and I try to define the terms for them and say, "Well, what they're saying is this, and here's what they mean, and this is why I think you're misunderstanding them." And so I find myself doing a lot of translating back and forth between both groups.
Hmm.
So do you consider yourself a humanist now? Is that a label that you would choose for yourself?
Yes, it's the one that I'm the most comfortable with. I mean, I would also call myself an atheist. I do embrace that label, mainly because it makes so many people mad. historically, when you want to change the perception of a label, the best thing to do is embrace it and then help redefine it, or at least help show that maybe people have some preconceived notions that are wrong about it. And that's part of why I embrace that label. But it's not a very full or descriptive label, because it only answers one question. you know? Mm-hmm. And to me, humanist is a better word because it answers a lot more questions about what I'm about, what I do believe in instead of what I don't believe in, and what I'm after in life.
And you've just started a humanist group down there, is that right?
There is a group that just started in the last 6 months or so. Some friends of mine have put it together. I've tried to help, but I've been busy juggling. I am a member of the Mississippi Humanist Association. We do have a state chapter now that's official, and they've already started some projects like some blood drives, some clothing drives, and they've donated some school supplies to a local school in the inner city district. So they're just now getting started up. But yeah, we're really excited about that because it gives a place to plug in and to be of service to the community in a way that doesn't require subjecting yourself to, you know, church doctrines.
So, Neil, for the blood drives, do you get the blood from all the babies you sacrifice?
Yes, and then, of course, we drink them.
And then you drink it afterwards.
But
we
share with the Red Cross just because we want to be nice.
Well, it's important to share.
Yeah. We want them to think we're nice. That's the goal.
All right. Well, Neil, one of the main reasons that I wanted to get you on is because you wrote an article that I read that I just loved it, What I Gained When I Lost My Religion. And one of the things that initially caught my attention was that you framed it as an overall gain. And I think that's important because you hear a lot of atheists and secular folks refer to it still in Christian terminology as losing religion, as abandoning religion, or just very negative terms, but you don't have that view, and I thought that was kind of cool.
Well, yeah, there are losses, and I'll be honest, but most of those losses are social, because what happens is people no longer approve of you because now you're outside their group. But if you were to factor out the social disapproval, it's definitely been a net gain for me personally to gain what I would call a more harmonious relationship with the world around me. You know, part of being a part of a faith tradition is you're told the way things are supposed to be, but you're always in tension between the way they say things are supposed to be versus the way things really are. And it's an exhausting position to be in, and you're always trying to reconcile them, and it never reconciles. Now that I'm a humanist, I would say that I'm finding that the world makes more sense to me. You know, I don't come with expectations that are unrealistic or that don't fit the way the world is. And so the gains that I've gotten have come from just gaining a more harmonious relationship with the world, including a harmonious relationship with myself. You know, because a lot of what I tried to make myself do and be as a Christian before didn't fit me. You know, one of the examples that I gave in that list that you read in Time was that as a Christian, I was taught that I was supposed to judge people who don't have the same sexual orientation that I do. And that's one of the first things that I was able to drop when I realized that there wasn't anybody telling me how I was supposed to think about that anymore. So when I left my religion, I gained the ability to accept them for who they are and to become comfortable around them. So that's a good example of something that I gained after losing the judgment.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm here with Kim Ellington, and we're speaking with Neil Carter, Godless in Dixie. And you also mentioned the rediscovery of a love of learning. What's that about?
Well, you know, I should be careful and qualify that the version of Christianity that I was a part of was not a highly anti-intellectual version. You know, I grew up around fairly sophisticated, well-educated Christians, which is part of the reason why I'm less inclined to talk down to believers, because that's not the kind of believer that I was before, and that's not the kind of Christian that I was friends with. But there still were so many things about the world that didn't fit with what I was told about the way it's supposed to be, that when those blinders were taken off, I realized there was a wider world for me to study and to learn about. And there were so many new things to discover that all of that excitement that you had when you were a child, learning new things about the world, about science, about animals, about everything, it comes alive again because now you're not trying to force the world that you see into a mold, you know, to make it fit the way you're told. Part of being a very devout person is that you come to the world with a head full of answers. You know, and it's all about the answers. You know, you've got an answer for everything, but that's a lot less stimulating to have a head full of answers. And I encounter that same kind of attitude when I talk with Christians on the blog and on Facebook or wherever. They're so full of answers, and I can predict what they're going to be because I used to give those same answers. Now I've got more questions, but the questions are more exciting because they're open-ended. You know, they lead to new discoveries and they lead to possibilities that we haven't gotten to yet. It's a lot more broadening of your horizon.
So what were you writing? What was the book that you were writing when you realized that that wasn't what you believed anymore?
Well, I had gone from a traditional church environment, which is your standard Southern Baptist, you know, mega church type environments where I came from. And I never really felt completely at home there because of the formality. It just didn't fit me. And I felt like there was a lot of putting on airs. There was a lot of show and a lot of performance involved in that, and that really wasn't true to me. And so I really dove into Bible study, and in my study of the New Testament, I became convinced that the way church was supposed to be was a lot more informal and a lot more spontaneous, with more of a sort of a decentralized, distributed model of leadership. So I was drawn to what was called the home church movement or the house church movement. And I even relocated my family to Atlanta for about a decade to be a part of a house church movement there. It was international. It was small, but it was international. And I got to travel some with that, and that was really exciting. And over the course of those 10 years, I sort of formulated my own ideas about why church needed to be that way and how church would be better if it had more of a community focus, more of an intentional community to it rather than a building that you go to meet and listen to a performance. And it's funny because in a way, I think it anticipated a lot of what I was going to do afterwards, because when I was a Christian, my main goal was to learn how to develop communities, how to take people who were too disjointed and too separated from each other and try to build them into intentional community units. And in a way, that's becoming my focus as a humanist as well, because I look around at the free thought movement, and I see a lot of disjointed people who many of them are lacking and they're wanting more connection to each other. And they find it through social media, but there's still something lacking there, especially at the local level. So, for example, Kim, where you are in North Carolina, you know, you've got a great group that's got a lot going on all the time, and y'all have social get-togethers. Well, in Mississippi, that's hard to pull off. I'm amazed that North Carolina's been able to pull that off. But there's a lot of work to be done to help organize those groups so that people don't just get on their computer to connect with other freethinkers. They'll be able to go down the street and meet with them at the local, you know, gym or, you know, go see pub. A movie together or a restaurant. Pub, I was going to say that. Yeah, we do have a pub in Mississippi, I think, somewhere.
Ah. Yeah, anyway. It needs to be somewhere near your humanist, where your humanists get together.
I'm sure there will be alcohol somewhere close by.
Yeah. Now, is Mississippi, you're not a dry state, are you?
Well, not completely dry. It depends on where you are.
Okay.
You still can't buy liquor on Sundays. And yeah. My county is sort of dry. There's no liquor stores in my county.
Wow. Hmm.
Now, I heard somewhere that Jesus was big on the wine.
Yeah, but see, that was unfermented grape juice.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, see, he magically removed all the alcohol from it when he made it. I learned this when I was in high school, but it is a minority view. What's funny is that even though, say, Presbyterians, for example, they're fine with liquor. Well, they drink beer, you know, even the conservative ones. And when they celebrate communion, they have wine in the cup as part of communion. But in Mississippi, many of them don't serve wine in their communion. They serve grape juice. Even though they don't have a theological problem with alcohol, the Presbyterians, but here in Mississippi they change it because Mississippi is so anti-alcohol.
Wow.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
All right. So back to your list here. You got a lot of good things here that I want to talk about. Okay. You already talked about how you're less judgmental towards other people, and I think that's great. But you also mentioned that you're less judgmental towards yourself. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, you get a lot of unrealistic expectations about what people should be able to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And one of the main things that I have come to see was unhealthy about my Christian background is The Christian faith in particular has a really odd way of thinking about the self. It's very uncomfortable with the self. It sees the self as something negative, something that needs to be negated, and something that is a barrier, a hindrance to spiritual growth. And so if you read the New Testament, it talks in very negative terms about the self. And that's made its way into American culture too. When we talk about the self, we hyphenate words with self in front of it to mean something negative. And what I've come to see is that that's a very unhealthy way of looking at myself. You know, above all else, I was taught not to be selfish. But one of the biggest struggles for me working my way out of that is to realize there is a healthy way of appreciating yourself. And I was taught to straw man that, you know, to imagine something more extreme, where when a humanist began talking about having a better relationship with yourself, what a Christian, an evangelical Christian, hears is that you're going to make yourself the center of the universe. And the needs of everyone else have to be squashed in the interest of what you want. And that's not fair, because what I'm advocating for as a humanist is a balance between the needs of others and the needs of myself. And I'm going to be quick to be honest with you and tell you that I suck at this, because what I tend to do is I err on the side of forgetting myself, because that's the way I was raised. And I have a huge problem with self-neglect. So I talk a good game, and I want to get there to the point that I have a healthier view of self, but it takes a long time to unpack this baggage when you were raised on it the way that I was. But that's the kind of freedom from something that's unrealistic that I'm talking about when I was writing about that in that article. Yeah, you know, and that's, to me, that's one of the things that I would consider my main contribution to American humanism, is that I feel like I've got a really good grasp of the things that evangelical Christianity brings to the table that are anti-humanistic. You know, it's not just that evangelical Christianity has values that are different. It's that they're adversarial to humanism. They are anti-humanistic, because at the root of the evangelical gospel is the belief that people are broken. They're not as they're supposed to be. They're incomplete, and they're needing to be saved from themselves. And that's, in a sense, that's the very opposite of what humanism is. Humanism is the belief that people can pool their resources together and their strengths, despite their weaknesses, and they can build something that makes the world a better place, that makes life better than it was before. And that's a belief system I can get into, but evangelical Christianity says just the opposite, and it would see humanism as its, you know, polar opposite. And so, yeah, there's this very negative view of humanity, and that's what's got to be chipped away at, I think, if we're going to gain any ground in American culture.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, I would imagine that it's very difficult to do for some people that were born and raised into this, with this mindset. Now, I wanted to be sure that I'm not being stereotypical here. Would it be fair to say that pretty much that's universal, that whole idea of sinful humanity is universal across Christianity? Or are there some sects that really don't believe that, that are more humanistic?
It's the overwhelming majority. And I spend a lot of time trying to ferret that out, because I don't want to stereotype, like you said. I know that my background is limited. I mean, I did have a certain spectrum that I ran around within. But as I've rubbed elbows with Christians of different types, what I've found is there are certain elements that seem to run through almost all of them, except for the most liberal and progressive versions of Christianity. But in my writing, I've interacted a lot with progressive Christians, which sort of lean towards the liberal, the left end of Christianity. And what I found is that even the most progressive Christians still have this notion that we have to see humanity as broken. Because at its base, the Christian message is that humans need something bigger than themselves, that humanity cannot solve its own problems. That's at the root of the Christian message. And so, on the one hand, there are versions of Christianity that probably work their way out of that notion, but by the time they do, it's unrecognizable as Christian. And the rest of the Christian faith sees them as outsiders to them, the overwhelming majority, because the moment you erase the need for a savior, you've pretty much left what most people consider Christianity.
Yeah, that makes sense.
How do you incorporate humanism? You're raising your wonderful kids. How do you? They have a mixed parentage. Am I correct?
They do. They do. I mean, their mother is still a devout Southern Baptist, just as I was at one point. And so there's a lot of hard decisions for me to make, and I have to pick my battles. On the day-to-day issues, their mother and I will see eye to eye on, you know, disciplinary issues, teaching the kids to get along with each other, you know, getting them to clean up their dishes, all those sorts of things, most day-to-day issues. There are some moral and cultural issues where we differ from one another. And my task is to try to find ways to talk through those things with my girls whenever possible, in a way that doesn't polarize them toward or against either one of us. And that's tricky. But because both their mother and I have always been very academic in our orientation, she's a teacher, I'm a teacher, we don't mind the discussion. So I think that we're working at it. I will say that the deck is stacked unfairly against me because I'm the only person in their life that's not a devout Christian. While they will get two different sides to some issues, the ones that I choose to try to address with them, take like gay marriage, for example, which is something we brought up before. I've told them that I'm in support of marriage equality. They didn't have much of a response to that because they don't really know what to do with hearing that their father sees that differently from everyone else in their life. So I did what I could to explain what my reasons were for that. And they nodded, you know, they were polite. But that's something for them to struggle with, and I'm sure that it's difficult for them to know what to do with that. So there's a number of little things like that that I've begun to try to inch my way into exposing them to a different way of thinking without the need personally for them to think exactly like me, because that's not my goal. As a free thinker and as a humanist, I want my girls to figure out what they think for themselves. But they do need at least to get some exposure to a different way of seeing the world, and so my goal is to try to do that, and it's tough, I gotta admit.
Yeah, I think I would have, as a parent, one of the hardest things that I would have to deal with is my kids thinking that they were sinful, this whole concept of sin,
yes,
and that they were broken. I would have a very hard time with that, I think.
It's tough. It's tough. And I'm 40 now, and I still struggle with these feelings of inadequacy and insecurity and of being not right, because that was drilled into me at such a young age. And I absorbed it so well, even as a young adult. And so I know they're going to be dealing with that exact same thing. And I've heard it in their voices. I've heard it in their own self-description. You know, they're internalizing this message that says that they're broken and they're not right and they're sinful. And it's hard because I have a different message for them, but I'm greatly outnumbered.
Mm. Yeah.
So my hope is that, you know, I'm going to say what I can in a way that's not going to upset the apple cart, but maybe, you know, maybe when they're older, they'll decide that the way that I'm talking about them is more humane.
So, Neil, what do you guys do on Sunday mornings now?
Well, I sleep in. Well, that's not true. Actually, I get up and run really early most mornings. My girls go to church with their mother. After I left the faith, my wife and I tried to work through our issues, but we were not successful in maintaining our marriage in the midst of our differences. Some people have been able to, but we found that we weren't. Just the way that our relationship was structured, it was too much for us. So we live apart now, and we divorced, and the girls continue to go with her to church. And they're there every time the doors are open, and it's a mega church, so there's lots to do. Hmm. On Sunday morning, I wake up and I make chocolate chip pancakes. And I get caught up on blogging and whatever else I'm doing and just chill.
Neil, do you offer your girls the chocolate chip pancakes?
That would really upset their mother.
That might be a very effective bribe.
It would. It would, actually. I think that there may come a day when if one of my girls says, you know what, I don't think I want to go to church this morning. I think I'm going to go hang out with Daddy. I'm going to say, it's about time, you know, and welcome them with open arms. But I'm not going to push that on them. Let's
okay.
just say that.
Neil, you said something that confused me. On Sunday morning, you run and then you have pancakes, chocolate chip pancakes, or do you eat the pancakes first and then run? Those two things don't seem to go together too well.
Well, I run so that I can eat chocolate chip pancakes, you see.
I got it.
That way I've burned off so many calories that now I can replace them with lots of chocolate.
All right. That answers
that's why
that question.
That's why I exercise. I exercise so I can eat lots of chocolate.
You actually put down better health on your list. Is there anything more to that idea of better health?
Well, definitely. You know, when you decide that this one life is all you get, it does reorient the way you look at your health. And what I found was, honestly, it didn't begin that way for me. It began with having a lot of angst to work out. Mm. I was the only person I knew who was asking the questions that I was asking when I was on my way out of my faith. I didn't have anybody to talk to. I hadn't yet discovered any online groups, and it was a couple of years after I had deconverted before I did. So it was a very solitary experience for me, and that's actually the way it is for a lot of people. Because I was in the middle of a church world, there was all this angst and dread because I knew that if I weren't a believer anymore, it was going to totally dismantle my life. Hmm. And that's exactly what happened. My whole social world fell apart. I had to start over again with all of my friendships. I pretty much lost everybody because it's not because they were being mean. It's just because for them, their faith was their whole life. You know, I mean, church is their whole life. So what if you don't do church? What if faith is not even a part of your life anymore? There was almost nothing for us to talk about. You know, in time, those friendships fell away. So I saw all that coming. I even knew that it probably was going to be more strain than my marriage could handle. And the angst of it gave me a lot of energy to work out. So I started running and I started lifting weights and I started swimming. I just needed something to take out my frustrations. And I lost about 60 pounds.
Oh, wow.
I had a lot of frustration to work out.
Imagine.
So by the time I got done, I found that I really felt great. And being in better shape just made me feel more alive. Mm-hmm. And I found that that really fit my new outlook on life really well, that just being stronger, being healthier, really made me feel a little bit more alive.
Yeah. And then you also have on your list better sex. And I'm wondering if the better sex is because you lost the 60 pounds. So you could do things in positions that you never even imagined.
It helps.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm here with Kim Ellington, and we're speaking with Neil Carter, Godless in Dixie.
I'm very limber, let's put it that way. Lots of stamina. Anyway, I don't want to get too detailed for your show, but what I did find was that having a different relationship with my own self and with my own body mm-hmm. made me able to enjoy sex in a new way. You know, as a Christian, I was taught to see sex as a positive thing, but it was almost a very strained relationship because on the one hand, you know, it would be terrible to just say that bodies are bad and sex is bad. You're not supposed to say that. But on the other hand, there's this vague feeling that you get from reading the New Testament that mm-hmm. bodies are kind of an encumbrance, you know, they're like getting in the way of being really spiritual.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a place where Paul talks about longing to be clothed with eternity and to be free of this like earthly tent. There's always this negative talk about being a physical person. And I, you know, there was even an element within Christianity over the years that tended towards asceticism. You know, especially true in the Catholic Church. Hmm. I'm pretty sure that the most recent pope before this one was known as a flagellator. I know that sounds like I'm talking about farting, but I'm not. I think that he had one of those, you know, ropes that he would hit his own back with.
Oh, no.
You know, there's even a Bible verse that says, or Paul says something about buffeting his own body in order to discipline himself. There's been a lot of speculation about what that means, but there is an ascetic element within Christianity that teaches you to see your body as something that's getting in the way. And when I let go of that, I learned to enjoy my body in a new way, and that affects the way you experience sex. Hmm. It means that sex is not something that is to be saved for a special occasion. It's something to be done a lot more often. It's something to be enjoyed for the sheer pleasure of it. in and of itself. And because there's this sense of owning your own body that comes from becoming a humanist, or there was for me, there was just more of a savoring, an enjoying of being a physical person, if that makes sense.
Daily celebration of life, baby.
Exactly. This is atheist communion. It's... Anyway.
I love it. That's exactly it. Well, yep. Not necessarily for everybody, but definitely I'll just share. That will be my experience indeed.
All right. And your word for it.
Neil, you mentioned Paul too. Paul also talks about how you shouldn't get married, but you know, if you really need to, then go ahead. And that obviously shows his stance on the whole sex marriage thing.
It does. And I sat through a lot of rationalization of those verses. But once I got free from the dogmatic structure of it all and looked at it with a little bit more of a fresh mind, I realized that the Christian faith was formulated primarily by two people, Jesus and Paul, both of whom, as far as we know, were single.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, depending on whether you're into conspiracy theories and Da Vinci Code and whatever else, there's been speculation that Jesus really had a wife and we just don't know it. Of course, a lot of atheists and humanists don't even think Jesus existed, but I tend to lean towards thinking he probably was a real guy. It's just that now there's a lot of layers of legend that have been put on top of him. But according to the New Testament, he was single, and so was Paul. And Paul said that he preferred single life. So you've got, you know, an entire religious tradition formed by single guys. And the most amazing trick to me is that in America, Christianity has come to be something about focusing on the family.
Right.
When really, if you read the way Paul talks about the family, there's a place in 1 Corinthians 7 where Paul actually says that family is a distraction from the things of God. He said he preferred that people stay unmarried because then they won't be divided in their interests between the needs of other people and the needs of the gospel and of ministry. So he actually encouraged people to stay single. And Jesus was kind of that way too. You know, there was a time when his own family tried to seek him out at one point because they needed something from him. Maybe they thought he was going crazy. I don't know. At one point there was talk like that. And when his family was knocking at the door, he said, "That's not my mother and brother. My mother and brothers are the people here sitting in here who are listening to me." You know, he sort of had this aloof attitude towards his family. And you know, there was a couple of people who came to him one time and said, "We want to follow you, but we first have got to bury our family members." And he just kind of pushed them away. Said, "Well, then you've got nothing, you know, no part in my service, because I'm not going to have people following me who are divided in their interests between these obligations and what I'm calling you to do." So there's a real negative attitude towards family that gets kind of muted when Christians talk about it. But if you go look back again and read how they talked, it's really kind of shocking.
Well, Jesus also mentioned about hating your family members, brothers and sisters and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Which is funny to me, because ironically, what they say is that was speaking in hyperbole. And they're correct. However, why do you use hyperbole? You use hyperbole to stress a point. You use hyperbole to drive a point home stronger. And what they're doing is just the opposite. They're taking what he was trying to say about prioritizing ministry over family, and they're trying to minimize it. They're doing the exact opposite of what he was doing. So for me, the big thing isn't whether or not he used the word hate. It's that they're embarrassed by the strength of that language, and they're trying to squash it. They're trying to brush it under the rug.
Yeah.
Because it's embarrassing.
All right. Well, I don't want to get too far off topic, but there is that whole idea that Jesus did believe. He was an end of times preacher, and he did believe, as did Paul, that this was it. These were the end of days, and everything was changing. So the whole idea of starting a family, it made no sense.
Right.
But then after you know, decades have passed, and they're like, all right, well, maybe this isn't happening right away, so we better reinterpret these words.
Yeah. Well, what folks tend to forget who are pushing those ideas is that the idea is that supposedly God arranged the time frame in which these things happened. And if God is real and if God spoke the Bible, then he could have chosen to do it at any time, but he happened to choose to do it in the middle of that apocalyptic expectation. He could have done it any other time. And it seems to me that if I wanted to write a book that had a lot of instructions about how to have a good family life, I wouldn't have picked a couple of guys that thought the world was getting ready to end. You know, that was a bad move.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
So one of the other things that you do, Neil, that I am absolutely fascinated with is that you kind of speak for atheists in churches and to religious crowds. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I love doing that. Well, it's like I said back when I was talking about being an ambassador. I feel like that what I have a value to offer is that I feel like I understand how evangelical Christians think. And I feel like I understand basically how humanists and atheists think. And I feel like I can talk to both groups in ways that hopefully they both understand what each other's trying to say. And a couple of years ago, an invitation went out on The Friendly Atheist for anybody who is interested in participating in Interview an Atheist at Church Day. A friend of mine, who's now a friend of mine, Kyle Jones, was helping organize that with one other person, and they were setting it up all over the country. And in my state, there happened to be one pastor who was interested in doing that. He was unusually liberal for a Mississippi pastor, and he was interested in doing this. And so I contacted him, and we got together. We had lunch a couple of times, and we talked through what each of us would want from this kind of an interview. And he let me get up in front of his church, and he asked me a series of questions, and I talked about how I felt like atheists were misunderstood by Christians. And it was very well received. And that video has gotten a lot of hits, and I probably get more messages from people because of that video than anything else I do. Because what they say is, when you took the time to talk about what atheists think in front of Christians, and you put it in a way that was understandable to them and was respectful to them, it gave us something that we can share with other people. I've gotten so many messages from people that say, I've been trying to find a way to talk to my parents about how I'm different now and how I think differently now. And I was able to send them a link to your video, and it sparked a conversation, and we had a healthy conversation about our differences around the dinner table. And that was something I'd been putting off for 6 months. But when I came across the video, it gave us a starting point. And I hear that all the time, because not enough people do that. There's been, a lot of people who didn't grow up with church and didn't grow up with religion have a lot of negative things to say about faith. And I don't blame them. But at the same time, they can't identify with people of faith because they never were one themselves. But I was, which puts me in a good position to try to speak to both groups and to represent both groups at times. And doing that in church is awesome. I mean, I feel very comfortable in front of a church group because I did that for a number of years. So I'm hoping actually that maybe there'll be more opportunities to do that in the future.
I think so. I hope so too, because I think we can learn. I am one of those people. I grew up with atheists my whole life, and faith makes no sense to me at all. And not because I'm obstinate about it or I just think it's stupid. I just don't get it. I don't understand that mindset at all. So
yeah, but you're not mean about it.
No, not at all. I hope not.
You're not.
But I also don't. It's weird. I can't identify with that feeling. When I hear the Christians, some of them around here talking, it sounds like a different language to me.
Yeah.
Like literally, like different vocabulary. So I love that you can do that, and I think that's an incredibly valuable skill towards continuing to like intersectionality between all the people.
I'm collecting friends that can do this. One of the things that I've done over the last 6 months or so is get connected with the Clergy Project. Mm-hmm. And there's still a lot more dreams than there are realities so far in that, because a lot of the folks that are in the Clergy Project are still very closeted. And I identify a lot with them because I have a lot of ministry in my background as well. And when I write stuff about my own deconversion, I found that they connect with it really well. And one of the things that I'm doing is I'm trying to seek out some of these people like myself who feel very comfortable up in front of people in a church. Who might be willing in the future to do more of that. And I'd like to put together a team to do this on a regular basis. You know, at this point, that's just a dream, because honestly, most churches are not comfortable with this idea. I mean, it sounds proselytizing, but my goal would not be that. My goal would not be to go in and steal sheep. You know, my goal is I want to see better communication facilitated between people who are on opposite sides of this divide, because that's the story of my life. You know, I do that on a daily basis in my life as an atheist living in Mississippi, where all of my family are devout believers. So I want to see better communication facilitated between these groups. So I'm kind of got this dream of assembling a team. I'm thinking of calling them the Church Whisperers. Anyway, I want some friends who can do the same thing that I've done. And I've probably got four or five now that have said, oh man, I would love to do that. going back to the pastor that I met with on the video, he really was the only pastor in my area who would have been interested in doing this kind of thing. He had even done something similar by inviting a Muslim leader to his church to interview him a few months before, which was, you know, pretty controversial in and of itself. But because it was at least a man of faith, the church was willing to accept him, you know, and listen to what he had to say. In my case, it was a lot scarier for them. Just the word atheist has such a shock value to it for them. And so a lot of them had a big problem with having me come to their church. A lot of them wouldn't come to the meeting, and they even had to have an emergency meeting just before the meeting itself, the interview, to, I guess, try to dissuade the pastor one more time. And he finally said, you know what, guys, you really don't have to sit in on this if you don't want to. So he left it open for, you know, folks to see it as optional. And it, like I said, it was well received, but that pastor also left the state 2 months later and moved to another state. Wow. So I have a feeling that he was emboldened by the fact that he knew he was on his way out. And he didn't have to worry so much about whether or not he was going to get a lot of flack for this. And now that he's moved away, honestly, I doubt there's anybody in the state who would be interested in doing this, at least from any sort of an evangelical Christian background.
You should follow up on that guy to find out if he became an atheist.
No, I'm pretty sure he's not. but, you know, it really would be very difficult to get churches to agree to this. And so that's the biggest challenge. I have no shortage of atheist friends who would love to do this and who I think could do a great job of being respectful and of not coming in to steal sheep or anything, but do just like I did, which is just to facilitate better communication and try to promote better understanding between the groups. But the hard thing is finding people on the Christian side who are willing to do that, because it's a lot more of a threat to them. You know, atheists are used to being exposed to a lot of different viewpoints and wrestling with them and debating them. But in a very traditional church environment, you don't get that. You're used to getting everything from one perspective. And there's really not much of an upside for them as far as they see the situation. What I generally tell them is that I think that they could benefit from talking to people like me, simply because we're a growing demographic, you know, from an evangelist's viewpoint. One of the things you're supposed to do is to try to take your message and learn how to contextualize it to different target audiences. And, you know, the research continues to show that people like me are growing in number, the nuns. You know, we're getting to be a larger group. Or actually, I have a second group, a subgroup of the nuns that I call the duns. And that's the group that, it's not that we were never a part of the religion. We used to be. It's just now we're done. And that's a significantly harder group to reach, because if you're pitching your sales pitch, your religion, to a group of people who have never heard of it before, they might be somewhat receptive because of the novelty. But when you're trying to use the same sales pitches on people that used to give those sales pitches themselves, it doesn't work. And so we're a harder group to reach. And so one of the things that I think I like to offer to churches who might be interested is, you know what, you ought to talk to us and let us answer your questions, because maybe you'll learn something more about how to relate to us. And if evangelism involves building relationships with people like me, then it would do you good to learn a little bit more about us.
For sure. Now, isn't there a date in May? Maybe it's May, like a world religions or like a speak to somebody outside your faith kind of thing. I don't know if that's Southern Baptist or if it's something else.
No, that wouldn't be Southern Baptist. There might be some faiths that have that, but Southern Baptists, when they talk to people from other religions, it's missions and evangelism. You know, they might have a day in December where they're collecting money for foreign missions. You know, and during that week, they'll have speakers come in from other countries who are missionaries in other countries, and they might talk about different cultures and that sort of thing. But there's generally not an openness, at least in my tradition, my background, there's not an openness to having people come in who are not even of the Christian faith to talk. That's just not heard of.
Well, Neil, this has been a lot of good stuff here. You have a lot of good things going on, and you told us already about your website, Godless and Dixie. What's the URL for that?
The easiest thing is just to go to pathios.com, And if you click on the atheist button, you know, they have several faith channels. But the URL is patheos.com / or is it forward slash? I forget. slash blogs and then / again, Godless and Dixie.
All right, Neil. Well, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank y'all.
Thanks, Neil. Bye.
All right. Bye.
All right. That was Neil Carter. Kim, you and Neil go way back, don't you?
We do. We've actually met, I think, 3 years ago when he came up to our group to visit. And I've been impressed ever since. It really is neat to me to have somebody. That translation that he does is incredible. I just think it's amazing. And he does such a good job of it.
So was that Neil plus 60 pounds that you met, or was it just the Neil?
No, it was Neil, this version. He looks good.
The new improved Neil.
Yep. Definitely. I was like, whoo, there's some nice biceps on that man. Can I say that?
Of course.
Yeah, of course. I appreciate it. It's part of that celebration of life.
That it is. All right. Well, that will wrap up this episode of the Humanist Hour. If you do have any feedback for us, we would love to hear it. Send an email to humanisthour@americanhumanist.org, or you could call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Also, a reminder to check out askahumanist.com, a wonderful website where you could ask questions to humanists, or if you are a humanist, you could provide answers, a wonderful resource. So once again, thank you for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.